On the Empire Podcast this week, we send our consciousnesses back into the bodies of our younger selves to interview X-Men Days of Future Past stars Hugh Jackman and Sir Ian McKellen. Plus, we discuss Bryan Singer's return to the X-Mansion in all its glory. And we round up all the usual movie news and nonsense on the only movie podcast that likes to wake up at the dawn of justice, but go to bed at the dusk of fiendishness. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast in association with Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code EMPIRE. Write that one down. You may need to remember it. EMPIRE. As ever, three is the number of people who are joining me on this week's podcast. They are podcast editor supreme and all-round dog lover, Ali Plum.
Hello.
Planet of the Apes guru supreme and all-round banana lover, Dan Jolin.
Ook ook.
And geek queen supreme and all-round Winchester dragon lover, Helen O'Hara.
Gosh, a Winchester dragon, all my favourite things in one.
We have some questions that you've been sending in all week. Thank you for that. This first one is from Twitter, at Justine Ask, who says, will Kim Newman ever appear in the pod? And is Tom Waits the greatest musician slash actor to have ever lived? I'll address the first one first. Kim Newman will probably appear in the pod. He'll cross oceans of time to be with us when he has something to promote. which, given that he's Kim, is every 5 seconds.
We can't afford him otherwise. He's out of our league.
We can't afford him. Seriously, the man is mega expensive. But he'll come in and that'll be fun. I look forward to having Kim.
Absolutely, he's great.
In the pod booth at some point. Right, is Tom Waits the greatest musician slash actor to have ever lived?
In a universe that contains, like, you know, Snoop Dogg's performance and Starsky & Hutch,
or indeed those Money Supermarket adverts that he's doing right now. Have you seen
those?
I mean,
right? Gosh.
Have you seen those adverts?
I always consider William Shatner as a musician foremost and an actor second. And the same goes for...
Leonard Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy, yeah. Russell Crowe. I mean, really? He can grow up with the best of them. No, the actual answer to this is The Boss. Because, of course, he is in High Fidelity. And that does make him an actor. And High Fidelity is one of... Not our boss. You old joker.
It's always a joy having you in the pod booth, Dan.
I love you, Dan.
Yeah.
I love you.
Do come more often, Dan. But surely the question means a musician who has a great music career and a great acting career. For example, Elvis.
And Justin Timberlake.
Yes. Elvis had a great music career, not necessarily a great acting career.
But does have some great movies in his canon.
Does have some great movies in his canon, absolutely. But Justin Timberlake, great music career.
And has appeared in really good films.
You could argue, and has appeared in really great films. I'd put him ahead of Tom Waits because I'm not a big Tom Waits fan, musically.
Mark Wahlberg.
But his musical career, is it on a par? Is it really... I mean, what level would we put that at?
Well, I mean, you know, I would say it's on a par. Judging by the trailers for Age of Extinction, I'd say it's on a par with his performance in that film, but let's see.
Also, bear in mind, he was a totally different person back then. He was... Marky Mark, and that's a bit like PJ and Duncan and Ant and Dec. They're different people. That was another time.
What?
Chris, I'll have to explain this to you, but essentially PJ and Duncan are the same people as Ant and Dec.
No.
Wait, but they have different names.
No. You know, like X-Men Days of Future Past, they did something similar, but with...
Oh, okay, so PJ and Duncan are young Ant and Dec.
That's correct.
Oh, okay, I got you.
So where do little Ant and Dec fit in?
Has anyone seen Alien Autopsy?
I have.
Have
I was on set of Alien Autopsy.
Were you? Did I send you?
Yeah, someone did.
Really? You
yes.
were on set of Alien Autopsy?
I was. It was at Elstree Studios. No, sorry, Ealing Studios. And I interviewed them both when they were wearing bathrobes over whatever their costumes were. I saw the alien that was being autopsied.
Spoilers.
Yeah, well.
Helen, I've known you for too damn long, and that is the best thing I've ever heard. What were they like? I hear they're lovely.
They were absolutely lovely.
Yeah?
Completely delightful.
How many times did you get the names wrong?
I carefully didn't use their names because I couldn't remember which one always stands on the left.
I love the joke in Love Actually where Bill Nighy's being interviewed by him and he goes, that's a very good question, Ant or Dec. And that's the only good thing about Love Actually.
Not true. There's that bit with the signs, which is cute. Which we've
talked
about.
Do not go. No.
No.
Oh, also, the bit with Rowan. No, no.
Gregor Fisher's quite good, I guess.
Oh, I actually really like Hugh Grant prattling about dancing to Girls Aloud. I enjoy that.
Yeah, I quite like that as well.
Is Tom Waits in Love, actually?
Well, that's why he isn't the best.
Oh, okay. I genuinely thought I've excised most of that movie from my memory. He could well have been in
it. No,
Love
he
actually.
Wasn't. He was not in it.
Okay.
But right. He would have made it better.
Would he have done? Okay. Interesting. Any other answers? David Bowie had a decent movie career.
Yeah, you're right. He has appeared in some really great movies. Now I think about it. I mean, I'm a bit here and there with The Prestige, but, you know, The Man Who Fell to Earth is a classic. If you ever want to see a man stir a gin and tonic with a pistol whilst he watches a bank of TV screens, that's your movie. He's great in that.
And obviously Labyrinth as well. I love The Prestige, by the way. Madonna, where do we stand on Madonna? Where do you stand on Madonna?
I actually quite like her in Dick Tracy. I think she's very good in that. Beyonce's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's been good.
Eminem was very good in 8 Mile.
But you know, that was a great performance.
I liked him in Funny People, though he wasn't really acting.
I suppose there's an argument he was kind of playing himself in 8 Mile as well. But,
kind of. I think you might be right. There were similarities to his life. I only realised in retrospect that maybe it was about him a bit.
Yeah, Kim Basinger is his mum.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
If anyone's seen The Magic Christian or Give My Regards to Broad Street, then we'll know that Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr should not be up for this discussion.
Dolly Parton. Done. Let's go home.
There's Mick Jagger is in that sci-fi weird movie.
Free Jack.
Oh, my God. With a crash helmet.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another thing where someone goes back in time.
Is it?
Isn't it? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
X-Men Free Jack.
Yeah. Well, no, hang on. No, he gets pulled forward in time. Because that's the film where Anthony Hopkins wants a new body and Emilio Estevez is a race car driver and he's in a crash and he's going to die, but they snatch his body just before the moment he dies and take it into the future so that he can become Anthony Hopkins' new body. And then he escapes and Mick Jagger chases him.
Are you saying this wasn't a good film? I mean...
It's just one of those bad films that stays in my head, just absolutely lodged in there.
I happened to see recently on Sky The Country Bears, in which Elton John cameos. And since that's clearly the greatest film ever made, then I think Elton John might win this.
Chris Christopherson!
But I will say, I don't think any of us around this table know Chris Christopherson's musical oeuvre well enough to say that he wins in that category, but he's certainly a fantastic actor.
I saw him once on the Johnny Cash show.
That'll work. That'll do for me. Chris Christopherson it is.
Didn't he sing Islands in the Stream with Dolly Parton?
I was Kenny Rogers.
Bringing it. Oh, epic.
How
fail.
You beardist.
You racist.
I can tell bearded men apart. Yeah, that's true.
Oh, if they haven't got their tops off, you can't tell the difference.
She's all about the CW, not CNW.
There you go. I would also suggest The Spice Girls.
Why would you do that?
Why would you do that?
Because the film they made, if you rewatch Spice
Irony
World,
points.
And you should, because Spice World is a film... I honestly cannot recommend. If you are ever stuck for something to do, go and watch Spice World. If you've just broken up with somebody, go and watch Spice World. It is fun. There are cameos from everyone. Meatloaf drives a bus.
Meatloaf!
Bob had bitch tits.
Yes.
Bob had bitch tits.
Spice World is absolutely amazing. I went to see it at the cinema.
With Alan Cumming.
When I was at the height of my Spice Girls mania, when I could recite all the lyrics of Two Become One.
There aren't that many in Two Become One.
I need some love like I never needed love before.
I want to make love to you, baby.
I had a little love.
Set your spirit free. It's the way
I'd like
you
to leave
be.
Now.
Yeah, what's the next question?
Next question is... the next question, good question, Dan, is from @NCLowe, who asks, as it's USA TV renewal season, are there any shows you think should have ended way before they actually did?
Yeah. EastEnders.
Dum, 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 dum.
That whole Den and Angie arc, when that was over, why did they carry on? I don't understand.
They should have done a film spin-off and be done with it.
Actually, there was a trailer came on for EastEnders last night, just before Great British Menu. I turned to my wife and went, who the hell watches this shit? I began to turn into my dad, I realise that. But honestly, this is now in his, 57th endless monotonous... I know, not 57. But it's just an endless stream of bad accents and misery. This is awful. Just kill it. Kill it with fire.
In shows that we might actually have liked in the first place news, I would like to propose...
Fair enough.
..films or shows like Dexter, the final season of which was Drek.
Are we sticking to US TV shows here, or can we throw in British ones?
I think we can throw
well?
In some British ones. I've got a British one written down here as well. I would also, much as I love it, and you know I'm on record as loving it, but Babylon 5, he rushed season 3 and 4 to kind of compress the whole arc into 4 seasons instead of 5 because he didn't think he'd get a 5th, and he did.
He being J. Michael Straczynski.
That is correct, yes.
Babylon 5 is a big pile of shit.
No, it's not.
No, the correct response is Get Out.
My trouble with Babylon 5 is it does Babylon a bit.
You're both terrible people. Also, I think the likes of the X-Files, certainly, is a show that started off brilliant and I think has been kind of tarnished by its later seasons being less than brilliant.
I was impressed that they kept finding, different things that were weird that began with the letter X. Like, honestly, what? How many seasons was it by the end? Like 11?
Yeah, a lot of evil xylophones in that show.
All over the shop now, yeah. It's sad, really. I mean, it's not like 24, which is preposterous, and you like it or you don't, and let's not raise it to a high art, and so what if it goes on more? What does it really matter? X-Files had the potential to just sign off and be great forever, and it didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'm going to throw some comedies in there. Frasier should definitely have ended.
Gotcha. Oh, yeah.
When Niles and Daphne got married, it was such an easy situation to cut off.
And weirdly, as a huge, huge Friends fan, I just do wonder if they went on one season too long.
That just said, it does have some... I agree.
This is the thing.
But I don't think it's the most egregious one I'll talk about.
Every episode of Friends has at least one or two laugh out loud moments in it, in my opinion. But, yeah, Rachel Joey thing.
There's a kind of a difference here, I think, between there are some shows where the last season or the last couple of seasons weren't as great. You know, they peaked before their last season. Something like Buffy peaked around seasons 3, 4, 5, and then 6 and 7 were not quite as good. But there were so many great moments in those that you wouldn't want to lose them completely. I would put The West Wing actually in the same category. There were great moments in those final post-Sorkin seasons.
And Battlestar Galactica as well.
Absolutely.
I was aware that it was going off and off. You know, do you know what I mean? It was going a bit wrong, but I kind of didn't want it to end because I enjoyed it, the character so much. And then at the very near, a bit like, yeah, kind of. It never hit the peak of third, fourth season, did it?
And in that category, I might put The Simpsons, which still has moments of genius, but is not hitting the consistent heights of genius that it did in its earlier years.
Yeah. I compare and contrast, for example, with South Park, which is in season 16, I think, and is still as fresh and funny and fucked up as it ever has been. I'm going to throw in, just for controversy's sake, The Wire. The fifth season of which is not as good as what went before, although I quite like the fact they brought the focus back on McNulty and the police work. But there are a lot of critics of the fifth season, especially the fake serial killer plot, which people thought took the show somewhat beyond the realms of reality.
I like that plot. But I agree it pushed it, and I think but it's all a matter of relativity, I think. Mm. I think the fifth season of The Wire is better than most other television.
Yeah.
It just wasn't as good as what went before.
No, I agree.
And also you wouldn't want to lose that ending, and which, you know, essentially, you know, explains the whole thing.
Yeah, oh god, yeah, I just remember that season that makes me so sad. I've got a whole list of these. ER, Weeds, The OC, when Marissa went, they should have canned it. Happy Days, Invented This, Jumping the Shark, Roseanne, they win the lottery.
Oh god, that's awful.
I adore House, but that flips away.
I stopped watching it.
Heroes had trouble with obviously the writer's strike, so I can't really call out on it should have cut its cord. You know, Only Fools and Horses, how many bloody specials has that had?
I was just about to say Only Fools and Horses, which seems like sacrilege, but honestly, towards the endless 90-minute specials, once they won the lottery, that show should have finished. They should not have come back, I think.
The US Office, I'm a very big fan of. Again, it was like Niles and Daphne getting married. There was a natural cutoff point when Michael Scott left, and they kept going. I'm currently polishing it off right now. Like, I'm finishing up. There are some episodes which are very funny and have very funny moments. Some of them this is honestly what you had at the bottom of the big whiteboard. Hey, here's an idea. Yeah, we could do that this time. I think Dwight Schrute comes up with a crazy alternate Christmas, which kind of signed, oh god, and it's her off Doctor Who,
Catherine Tate.
Wow, she gets better, but to begin with, wow, she's bad. I would finally say Will and Grace also should have ended.
Okay, interesting that there's only one British TV show in that, because British TV shows only do the 6 episodes a series thing, generally speaking, and they don't tend to overstay their welcome,
apart from Red Dwarf
to an extent, although the last season series was pretty good. I think News at 10's really gone downhill since Trevor McDonald left.
Have I Got News For You actually has gone downhill. Like,
it has.
The number of times they make a joke and it drives me up the wall where they go, Scottish people, they eat oats, Liverpool, insert, like, it's just so basic. Or who'd want to live in Devon because they don't have electricity, ha ha ha. You can see, like, especially female guests just feeling incredibly uncomfortable with, like, really root one crass stuff. That said, when they get people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, whatever his name was, on the other day, and you go, you are a buffoon, and it's nice watching you be a buffoon.
It's tricky though. I mean, for a long running series to keep up the quality, but once you get to episode 112 of anything, you're just basically just going through the motions, aren't
remarkably
you?
Remarkably specific. Yeah.
Honestly, jokes about bananas, Planet of the Apes,
Supernatural.
Sick of it. sick of it.
I'll be wheeling out impressions next.
No.
God, that would be bad. No. Finally, okay. True Blood and Desperate Housewives.
Okay.
Oh, also Sex and the City.
So everything, basically.
Nothing's ever perfect, apart from things that we've decided are perfect, and then about 10 years after watching them and remembering them fondly, you realise they weren't as good as you thought they were. Anyway, what's the next question?
Next question, Ali, I'm so glad you asked, is from Facebook. This is from Daniel Parkin via Facebook. He says, with wanting to be first to see a new movie legally, absolutely right, don't get me started, I know someone who makes a habit of watching movies on an illegally streaming thing, and rubs it in my face and I get very angry.
Sorry,
anyway,
we will not get you started, Chris.
So Daniel Parkin continues, before spoilers or friends / post, before they see the movie, he wants to see it legally. It's getting very, very expensive to have a night at the movies. Godzilla, for example. He goes into detail. Friday night, IMAX 3D, £16.50 a ticket, times two, slip brackets, date. Well done, Daniel. Two drinks at the cinema bar. Just two? It's a date, Daniel. For God's sake, push the boat out, mate. £12.10. Cinema snacks, drinks, hot dog, popcorn, coffee, £22.40. Total, £67.50. P.S. I'm not tight. I just wanted to hear your thoughts.
Here's my solution. You sneak booze and food in.
Just take your own stuff in, like I do.
I take my own movies in, which really helps.
Snickers bar in the bag.
Banana.
Bottle of water.
I mean, think how impressed your day would be if you turned up with homemade brownies or something. And any idiot can make brownies.
Or a bunch
no
of
offense,
bananas.
I'm not calling you an idiot, Daniel.
I'd say that there are different deals, and it wouldn't be appropriate necessarily to go, oh, well, this company does this, but there are Tuesday nights that are cheaper. Obviously, there are Orange Wednesdays. There are deals, you know, you have cards that allow you to go to the World of Cine. Hello, Jason Isaacs. To see films on a cheaper basis, and depending on where you are. I would also say there are times when I'm willing to spend more. You are saying IMAX here, and that is expensive, but I find when you're going to the IMAX, that is a really big deal, and maybe that is expensive. It is expensive, but you are going to the IMAX, so that's what you get. You will pay more. And I like going to smaller cinemas. Often they'll do older films or more recent films, but a bit later.
But the point is, he's right. It is getting very, very expensive.
Oh, gotcha. Cinemas.
And we live in a bit of a bubble. We don't often pay to see movies at the cinema. We get to see the stuff, by and large, for free. Very, very privileged.
But we do.
We don't. But there's a certain disconnect, I think, for us in terms of what most cinema goers go through. And it is vastly expensive. When I do go to the cinema, it's like, excuse me, how much? When I first came to London,
I
paid for two tickets to see Mummy Returns, and I gave the lady a £20 note, and I got £1.50 back, and I went, excuse me, what?
Yeah, I would not understand why anybody would go to Leicester Square and not watch a film aside from the PCC. I mean, I'd only go to the PCC there, Prince Charles Cinema, because that kind of keeps prices low, and increasingly they're getting films quite soon after their release, if you're looking to see, especially Art House Fair. I remember growing up in Reading, it was £4 see a film, £3.50.
You get good deals, I mean, if you're a family man, like I am. It's not actually that expensive to take my kids to the cinema.
Oh, really?
During a daytime, that's actually not too bad. It's the big evening shows.
It's a Friday night.
I went to see Gravity with Mrs. Jolin, and it set me back quite a lot, including, you know, babysitter costs. So, you know, I feel Daniel's pain.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is what's driving people more and more towards waiting for streaming, or, in the case of the person who flaunted at my face, who shall remain nameless, they turn to illegal methods. And they don't even think it's illegal. They don't even know it's illegal. And that's the thing that gets me. And I wonder how much people need to be educated about this sort of stuff. I mean, honestly, I've had arguments with this person going, it's illegal. And they go, no. I bought an Android box from Amazon, and they wouldn't sell the box if it was illegal. It's like, no, you're an idiot. Anyway, don't want to get me started. But I do think people need to be educated in this sort of stuff.
I would say one of these... This is one positive I take from it. I love going to do Orange Wednesdays, and when I do, I know I'll always have a great audience because it's always packed, and there's always a great willingness that they've waited this Wednesday to go and see it, and I love that. And sometimes I'll see a film that I've enjoyed a lot and then see it again on Orange Wednesdays because it's got that.
And you can also get the 2-for-1 on Pizza Express.
Oh, bingo.
Bingo. Is it bingo as well?
Yes, bingo as well, yeah.
Awesome. Daniel, we do feel your pain. I don't know what they can do about it, honestly. Except for maybe, as Ali was saying, there's lots of initiatives to bring prices down and...
points cards.
So perhaps if we all join together and rise up and form some kind of revolution,
I think so.
That might work.
Also, student cinemas, if you're a student or know a student, I remember going as a student with friends who were also students for £1. You go to certain places, get great discounts.
Daniel, we hope you had a great night. We hope you got lucky. And if you have any kids, do name them after us. Thank you so much for your questions. As ever, if you want to get in touch with us, we are on Twitter as at Empire Magazine. Please use the hashtag Empire Podcast or we won't see your questions. You can Facebook us, as Daniel did. We're Empire Magazine on Facebook. And you can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. Got a lot of spam this week.
I've got an idea as well. We talk about things every week and we're talking about musicians that became great actors and TV shows that should have, you know, whatever. If you've got any thoughts, do tweet us in or email us in, and I guess next week we might mention them if they're especially good or if we have the time or we remember.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just so make it a conversation, you can be part of the gang.
It's never too late in a show's run to freshen things up.
I agree.
Now it's time for our first X interview. Sir Ian McKellen first played Eric Lencher, a.k.a. Magneto, in X-Men back in the year 2000. Just like Busted. No, that's year 3000. Sorry. And now here he is, back as a character after an 8-year absence in Days of Future Past. I went along and spoke to one of our most venerated knights about returning to Magneto, saying farewell to Magneto and taking my job. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by Ian McKellen.
Hello.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, yes. Nice to be in Soho in the middle of London.
Looking out of a hotel room window?
Yes.
Would you much rather be out there?
No, I'm very happy in here. It's nice and warm and a cup of coffee is available.
This movie, Days of Future Past, seems in some ways almost a farewell to Magneto for you. Is that how you saw this movie? Is that how you approached this movie? Or do you think you might play this character again?
Well, I mean, things are never always as they seem to be. I mean, I could swear in the last movie, X-Men movie, I saw Professor X blown to smithereens by Jane Grey. And guess what? Sir Patrick is back with us. That's the nature of the comics, you know. They would go into the past and into the future, and they would change the future. They'd change the past. The characters weren't always consistent. They had different histories that were invented, and so the story rolled on for 30 or 40 years. And mm-hmm. I'd be very happy if the same were true of the movies. And never say die.
If it is to be your last go in the helmet, yes, as Magneto, you've also said farewell to Gandalf. And I just had this feeling that, you know, I have this image of you now Gandalf's in the past for you, Magneto's
in
the past.
Well, that's sweet of you to be concerned, but it occurred to me. I mean, here we are, the premiere's tonight in May in London for X-Men, which may be my last one. And in December, yes, it'll be the final mm-hmm. Hobbit movie.
Yeah.
But I know that Tolkien wrote other stories about Gandalf and his merry men, and who knows whether they mightn't reach the big screen. But no, I do feel there's a, if not a line drawn, there's a pause here. I have come to the end of something, but what the future will bring, I don't worry too much about. And if I didn't get a chance to be in big, big movies again, there are always smaller movies, and I'm about to do one, an independent movie in which I play Sherlock Holmes, age 93, a film set in London. You know, when you're making a film, it doesn't matter how big or small it is, it's making a film, it feels the same. Mm. But I think I will miss the razzmatazz of these big these big openings and these worldwide successful films.
But as a theatre actor, for you...
Well, there's the theatre, always the theatre, I hope, as long as I've got the strength to get on stage and be heard. And that's a big part of my life and will remain so, yeah.
But I imagine for you it's always a case of on to the next thing. That's done, that's the past, let's move on. Yeah.
Pat Stewart and I feel ourselves so lucky to be allowed to be in these films. We can't really believe our luck. You know, it wasn't the way it was meant to be. We were going to be classical actors doing posh plays at Stratford-upon-Avon and coming to terms with the difficulties of Shakespeare and so on. Yeah. And suddenly we're in these rip-roaring hits. And I could take no credit for the fact that they're successful, but I'm very happy to be along for the ride.
Well, not only are you in rip-roaring hits, but you and Patrick have essentially annexed to the internet. There are huge portions of the internet devoted to you guys and the pictures you take and the things you got up to in New York. Mm. Do you keep an eye on that sort of thing, or is that...
I've always been interested in publicity.
Yeah.
As an audience and as a performer. Why do I go and see something? And do I see it because I've seen it advertised? Mm-hmm. And where is that advertisement? On the side of a bus or on the television or radio? In the newspaper, or is it because I've heard it's good? Do I read the critics? No, I don't. Actually, I go and see something because someone's told me it's good, and that someone is probably a friend, whose taste I know and can trust. Now, when you're on the other end of it, when you're performing in a film or a play, how do we get people to come and see this? Mm-hmm. How do we explain to them what it's about and why they would enjoy it? Nowadays, one can cut through the commercialism of advertising your product through the social media, where you can directly contact people who you know are interested in what you're doing, because they've let you know that in the past. It's a more reliable way of as it were, being a friend through the ether and saying, you know, you'd enjoy this. So we were publicizing the work we were doing on Broadway. We were doing two plays, Waiting for Godot and a play by Harold Pinter, No Man's Land. And we wanted to let people know we were there in New York. So Patrick's wife, Sunny, invented this idea that we should have this rather public bromance, which slightly exaggerates our feelings for each other. But we are good pals. We get on very well with each other. We each think the other is pretty good in everything, in life and in work. And so there was no effort at all. And they took off. They went viral. And I think perhaps we became more famous for doing the publicity than for doing the actual plays.
But it all paid off, I'm sure. It all put bums in seats, ultimately, indeed, and that's the important thing. But with you and Patrick, was it? You guys have known each other for a long, long time now. Before the X-Men movies,
We worked together in at the Royal Shakespeare Company in the 1970s, and although we must have met, we weren't friends, and we weren't in the same productions. And we did a play together for the RSC by Tom Stoppard. That was only for one night. So we really bonded had long chats and explorations of each other's minds and experiences when we were doing the first X-Men, which is, 15 years ago in Toronto. And we discovered what anyone could have told us, really, is that we're the same person, actually. I mean, we've had very similar careers, Patrick and I.
Yes.
It's true he's from Yorkshire and I'm from Lancashire, but we put that aside. You know, I think we both hoped and thought our careers would be no more, and we'd be very happy if they were just that, being in classical plays with good directors and lively audiences. And it's turned out that he's a massive star on TV, and I've been in Lord of the Rings, and we do these X-Men movies. So we just keep hugging each other, saying, can you believe it? And we'll be in the next one.
We shall see. Time will tell. But I read on the IMDb, which isn't always correct, as you know, but I read that you once aspired to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. Is this true?
Patrick was a journalist.
Patrick was a journalist. Hugh Jackman studied to be a journalist
as
well.
Yes, is that right?
Yeah, indeed. So is journalism's loss movies gain, or the other way around? What sort of journalist would you have been?
Well, I hope I would have been writing for a posh paper, and that I wouldn't have had to distort the news to fit in with the predilections of the owner of the paper.
I can't see you phone hacking somehow. I don't think
I'd want to do that.
Yeah.
However, I mean, there is no more honourable job well done than being a journalist. Lives are put in danger sometimes to get the word out, the news out. And how else are we going to know what's happening unless some intrepid informer tells us? Would I be in that sort of journalist? I don't know. I would have tried. I mean, I do still write journalism on my website. I write constantly about my career. Mm. And it gives me great joy to say, right, I've written 500 words on that. I think I could get it down to 300 if I reorganize it and cut and paste and so on. And you can do that easily on the computer. And I really enjoy that. So, and the only writing I've ever done has been of a journalistic nature. It's been reportage. It's not been fiction. Mm. I've not written a poem or a play or a screenplay. Oh, I did one. Richard III. So journalism, I read a lot of. I still buy the newspapers and read them, and I'm full of admiration for those who can write well under duress. Someone who can report on a cricket match, for goodness sake, and make it sound interesting and exciting. I suppose my least favourite journalists are theatre critics.
String them up. well, Ian, there's an open invitation for you to write for Empire anytime you want.
Oh, I love Empire.
If you would like to write a review of Days of Future Past, 450 words by tomorrow with...
You see, I could do that, but yep. I'd have to drop everything else to do it. I don't know.
You might have
do you write reviews?
I write reviews, yeah. It's tough. It's my least favorite part of the
are
job.
Are you joking when you say
no,
it's
no,
tough?
It's my, no, it's my least favorite part of the job. I don't enjoy
well, there
that.
There you go. Yeah. It's very hard because you want to be honest to your own standards. You want to be kind to people who've put in a lot of work and effort and hope we're doing, trying to do their best. Mm-hmm. And then you have to inform all those faceless readers.
And all in that much space.
And that much space, right, well. Yes, that's right.
Which is quite tricky, indeed. But I just want to ask one last thing. You mentioned Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, yes.
A slight trick of the mind. What's your Sherlock Holmes going
to
be like?
I'm just starting, as you ask, to get to grips with the idea that I am going to be the latest actor to play Sherlock Holmes, but a Sherlock Holmes that others have not yet tried. He's 93. Mm-hmm. He's in retirement. And Conan Doyle, the author of the original stories, says that there was a retirement period when Holmes left London, went to live in Sussex. Mm-hmm. John Watson had got married. He kept bees. And why did he keep bees? Well, he wanted to collect the royal jelly. And why did he want that? Because he thought it would prolong his life. Mm-hmm. So like others of an advanced age, he's still determined to live even longer. And the film begins with him having returned from Japan in search of some elixir of not eternal life, but of rejuvenated life. Mm. And at the same time, he's getting more decrepit and the mind is going a little bit. And he reminisces about a last unsolved case. You see him trying to get to terms with that. So it's a play on Sherlock Holmes, and that'll be amusing. But it's also about old age, considerable old age. He befriends a young lad, a 12-year-old boy, who's obsessed with Sherlock Holmes's books and can't believe that the man actually exists. And you do really believe, as you're reading it, as I hope you will when you see the film, is that Sherlock Holmes is a real, yes. real person.
Yes.
But I never smoked a pipe. And that's for that deer stalker. That was John's idea. And I never called him Watson. So there are... we do correct a few mistakes that people make about him. Yes, it'll be fun. And it's directed by Bill Condon, absolutely. Who directed... the film I'm most proud of, perhaps, Gods and Monsters, mm-hmm. that we made a long time ago about James Whale. So it'll be a wonderful reunion.
Fantastic. Well, I wish you all the best. And thank you for joining us. Mm. Thank you very much. Take care.
Cheerio.
Problem with watching X-Men 2 last night, which mm-hmm. I did again in preparation, just, you know, because I wanted to take my wife to see Days of Future Past, is that I can't stop talking like this. It's really, really... discomforting. It's honestly, it's so weird.
I can see your problem there, Chris.
Can you see my problem?
I find it quite hard myself.
We're the future, not them. It's so weird.
You
anyway.
Are a god among insects, Chris.
Thanks, Dan. Okay, Ian McKellen there. Before we get on to the movie news, it is now time for a Squarespace-sponsored science bit brought to you by your friend and neighbour, Alistair Plum. Take it away, Ali.
This episode is sponsored by Squarespace, which is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy for you to create your very own professional website, portfolio, and online store. I have this. I'm not going to reveal the URL to you just yet because it isn't quite ready. I'm trying to get things just right, but it is, I can tell you, simple and easy, very well designed. It's got the drag and drop tools, which just seems so intuitive, and you get 24/7 support through either live chat or email with people both in New York City and Dublin. You even have the opportunity to do kind of online e-commerce with an online store. Every site comes with an online store if you want that. So just start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today, if that's what you feel like doing. And when you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code EMPIRE to get 10% off your first purchase and to show support for the Empire podcast, which is what you're listening to. Thanks, Squarespace, for sponsoring the Empire podcast. And remember, you know, a better web starts with your website. So there you have it. Thank you for listening to this small bit of blurb. It is gratefully appreciated. And now on with the show.
Lovely movie news time now. There's a biggie, which is the news that
Anthony Mackie will play Jimi Hendrix.
That's the one.
Oh, wow. Oh, sorry, excuse me while I kiss the sky.
What have you got here?
This is the news that Batman vs. Superman is no longer called Batman vs. Superman.
It's called Batman v. Superman.
It's called Batman v. Superman, : Dawn of Justice.
Bum, 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 bum.
I see what they did there.
Yeah. So, setting up a Justice League, perhaps?
But also, the Dark Knight is over, and it's a dawn of, like you said.
I think actually what it is, clearly, is the name of a legal case. This is the way that we write the names of legal cases. And Dawn of Justice simply backs that up. This is clearly going to be a courtroom film. I don't know if it's going to be Superman suing Batman. The way the title's written, it would obviously be Batman suing Superman for some reason.
He's a journalist, so he libeled him. So Clark Kent libels Bruce Wayne.
Potentially. No, we don't have all the facts yet.
I think it's a custody case over Robin, and you'll just get Batman going, "Where is he? Where is he? Where?"
Bat Kramer versus Super Kramer.
Essentially.
I like it. That would be a much more interesting movie than the one I'm sure they're cooking up.
Harsh.
It just feels to me, I loved the reaction on Twitter last night to this. That Twitter was being very, very funny about this last night. It is.
Have you seen a Transformers movie title recently?
Age of Extinction. Yeah, but that's just meaningless.
Dark of the Moon?
It's like, you have a movie called Batman vs. Superman, and the minute you decide to call it Batman vs. Superman, just stop. That's your title. You don't need anything else. People are going to go see it because it's Batman vs. Superman. You can call it something else, but not Dawn of Justice. Not this bland, meaningless nonsense that setting up a film that...
It is the kind of thing I would have written on the side of my pencil case when I was 9.
Yeah.
That's a little embarrassing for you. This whole Dawn of Justice, do we think that they were inspired by the Planet of the Apes? The Dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
Possibly. I mean,
there's probably... Somebody drove past a big poster of it, you know, and thought, that sounds good.
Well, also there was The Dark Knight Rises and Rise of the Planet of the Apes. So, you know.
Wow.
I am the Weaver.
Batman is an ape.
We're having fun with this, obviously, but from my perspective, it's fine. I don't really care. I'm sure it'll be good. It doesn't mean anything. It's just a name. It's got Batman in it. It's got Superman in it. I was really impressed with the picture. I like the look of the car. It's a movie. I'll see it, and I'll hopefully like it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a title. No one cares. No one's going to call it. No one's going to ask for 2 tickets to Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice.
No, please. No. Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice.
I'll still call it versus.
And also, of course, the reaction on our website. We had a poll up on the story. It's actually been positive. Much more positive than negative. So I think people may be more forgiving than...
The Twitter.
Most, yeah.
Yeah. I just feel that that when they released a picture of Ben Affleck and the Batmobile last week... Or whenever it was, 2 weeks ago, last week?
Last week.
Yeah. That there was a lot of goodwill, certainly, towards the movie, and I think they felt, they needed to get rid of that. and, you know, that they were uncomfortable with it. Because every step they've taken in this movie so far, they've had people throwing things at them. And I think they just wanted to get back to the place where they felt comfortable again. I'm obviously guilty of hyperbole here, but it is the worst title ever, and no one will ever come up with anything worse.
You are the worst at hyperbole.
And also, of course, it's shooting now. That's the other bit of news that came with that, isn't it? It's actually started shooting now. Detroit,
yes.
Illinois.
Yes.
South Pacific, Africa, apparently.
These all American states.
America wishes they were.
They're all American musicals.
So, yes, it's all over. It's globe-trotting, big globe-trotting production.
Do they say Africa?
I quickly read something before I came in here, and it just said Africa. So, you know, where in Africa? I don't know.
It does make me laugh when they have that. It's like I did a James Bond map, which you should check up on the website. I did this whole, it was a huge research project born of passion, and then at the end of it, no passion and disgust. But where I worked out every single location that James Bond went to, and one of them is obviously in the Mediterranean. He darts back and forth loads and loads of times. But then in one film, he just gets... There's a parachute incident over Africa, and it just says Africa. And you're just like,
Oh no.
What am I supposed to do with that? Anyway, do check it out. It's Bond's Travels, empireonline.com.
Good plug.
Thank you very much. Speaking of plugs, because this will actually work in hopefully rather well, Matthew Vaughn is making a movie, and the movie he is making is now called Kingsman: The Secret Service. Previously, it was just called The Secret Service. I'm still just as excited about it, but it's important that you know there's a name change. There's also a trailer that's gone up. The premise is that a young lad from in a city council estate in London gets plucked out of potential ignominy and a lack of a job and a lack of a real life by his super spy mentor, who's played by Colin Firth. And you, Chris, got to do a trailer breakdown with the director, Matthew Vaughn, and it has got me even more excited about it all.
Did I?
I think he did.
Oh, yeah. I did that the other day. I went along to Soho editing facility where Matthew Vaughan and his editor, Eddie Hamilton, another shout out to Eddie who listened to the podcast, are putting it together. They've got 10 weeks to go. They were both a little bit frazzled, but it looks fantastic, I have to say. I wasn't a huge fan of the comic book.
Which was written by Mark Miller.
Which was plotted by Matthew Vaughan. So there is shared DNA with the movie and the comic book. But it was written by Mark Miller, formerly of this podcast, and drawn by the brilliant Dave Gibbons. So it looks fantastic, and it swings along, and it's pacey, and there's not much more to it than that, I thought. The film, honestly, looks fantastic. Fawn showed me about 25 minutes of stuff in the end. Some of the action sequences in this look really, really great, and Colin Firth is going to be hilarious. He's Bond meets Steed. He's deadpan to the nth degree. He's phenomenal, from what I've seen.
I have a question.
Hello, Dan.
How is it different from Teen Agent and
Agent Cody Banks
and Stormbreaker?
It's different from those in terms of its tone,
okay,
and in terms of its attitude, and in terms of the violence and swearing quotient. This is extraordinarily violent. There's a phone showed me a set piece. I won't say too much about it. You see a little glimpse of it in the trailer. It's a sequence set in the church, and he showed me the set piece. And honestly, it's unbelievable. Once they finish and get all the effects sorted out, it's going to be unbelievably violent, as in the end of Brain Dead violent. And it's not the sort of thing you expect to see Colin Firth, one of our most noble actors and Oscar winners, doing, which I imagine was the appeal of it. Sam Jackson looks a good fun as the bad guy. Matthew Vaughan and Jane Goldman, who co-wrote the script and also did Stardust and Kick-Ass and X-Men First Class, they have a lovely handle of genre and genre expectations, I think, and they're very, very good at subverting things at every turn. And I've got real high hopes for this one. A lot rests on Taron Egerton, who's the unknown, had never made a film before, who was chosen over Jack O'Connell and John Boyega for the lead role of Eggsy. But he looked good from what I saw. Very, very solid cast. Mark Strong as Merlin, rocking a Scottish accent, Helen. I think you'll like that.
Always good.
Really, really good.
So
really
check it out on empire9.com. It's on the homepage.
We also have a trailer breakdown for the new Guardians of the Galaxy trailer, which will give you a little bit more insight into what the heck is going on with the raccoons and the trees and the talking and the aliens and the stuff.
So I like the Green Lady.
The Green Lady is very pretty,
I like the Blue Lady.
The Blue Lady is also very pretty, yes.
I like the guy with the abs.
Well, that narrows it down. Also this week, there was news that Alfonso Cuarón is apparently sought. Not necessarily even in 100% talks yet, but sought for the leadership of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. That is, of course, the Harry Potter spin-off. He gets a lot of praise, and rightly so, for being the one to take the world that that was set up in the Harry Potter, in the first two Harry Potter films, and shake it up in the third one and really set the franchise going. I mean, not set the franchise going, but really set the franchise free and give it a chance to be something, I think, better than it might otherwise have been. He's obviously still very close with producer David Heyman, who he made Gravity with, and this would seem to be an interesting challenge, even though he's not the kind of guy we associate with going back and doing sequels or anything like that, even though he's just done a major, major film and won an Oscar for it. This would seem to be an interesting challenge because, to me, combining sort of Jazz Age New York and the Wizarding World, just design-wise, I think could be the most gorgeous film ever. So I'm kind of hoping that he maybe takes that one.
It's kind of interesting. This guy kind of reinvented the wheel on Gravity.
Yeah.
I guess his next move is going to be very interesting.
He's also obviously working with Jonas, his son.
Yes.
On a slightly smaller scale film.
Desierto.
Yes.
Dan, you know Alfonso Cuarón.
Oh, I actually call it
better than anyone else in this podcast. Which is to say, not very well.
but you know.
Do you have any sense of what, is this something he might want to do? Do you see, is this almost like a break by the seaside for him after Gravity? Like doing this massive special effects thing?
He enjoyed doing Azkaban. I mean, you know, he it was by no stretch a bad experience
not
for him.
All, no.
So I think he's a good fit. I mean, you know, Gravity was an adult film, but not extremely one. And obviously Children of Men was very, very, very harsh. But you've got to remember, you know, his roots with the Little Princess. You know, he knows kids' movies and he does them very well. But he always, you know, there was an edge to Azkaban. I felt there was an edge to it that I didn't feel from the others that he brought to it. So I think it's cool. I don't know anything about these books, this new book though, or literally. I mean, it's got jazz romances in it or something. What's going on?
The book is barely a book. The book is not a story. The book is a tiny little almost pamphlet that J.K. Rowling produced for charity, for Comic Relief. So it was sold for like a fiver, and all the proceeds went to Comic Relief. It's not in any way a story. This guy is barely a character. He basically writes the introduction saying, yes, I went around and catalogued all these beasts, and here is the catalogue of all these beasts. And that's essentially all it is. So they're starting from square one. But of course, it is J.K. Rowling herself who is putting the story together for this one. I think we can probably trust her story acumen to be able to create something pretty interesting.
Presumably, though, it's going to have to be called Harry Potter, Fantastic Beasts.
I think they're literally just going with probably Fantastic Beasts.
I thought they'd probably change it to Fantastic V Beasts : Where to Find Them.
Dawn of Where to Find Them.
The Dawn of Finding. I've got something I'm so excited about. I've got to nip in and just quickly get it in. Is that the Coen brothers have announced their next project. And it's going to be called Hail Caesar, which obviously will be I've been waiting for it for so long. You know, finally the Coens are going to take on Something Funny Happened on the Way to the Forum. No, it's actually about a 1950s fixer in Hollywood, private eye type, who makes sure that the secrets and scandals of Hollywood are kept under wraps and that blackmail ensues. And I just love it when they get period. I loved it with Llewyn Davis, and this just feels so right for me. When they take on Hollywood briefly, when they have before, it's always a delight. And it's exciting. I always like knowing that they continue to make films. I almost feel like they're magical beasts.
And they were also in the news a second time this week for the news that they're planning to write a Cold War thriller that Steven Spielberg is currently potentially going to direct, with Tom Hanks starring. It's the story of a U-2 plane that was shot down over Russia. The pilot was taken prisoner. And it's basically about the lawyer, James Donovan, who was sent in to try and negotiate his release. So that would be the Tom Hanks role. Their purely screenwriting record is perhaps not quite as stellar as their screenwriting and directing record, but it's still a really exciting collaboration. Coen brothers plus Spielberg, that's intriguing to me.
It is odd how they have written for other people and the scripts have been lame. Obviously Gambit recently is a bad film, and of course they originally had Lady Killers was something they wrote for Barry Sonnenfeld, and then he dropped out at the last minute and they ended up taking it over, and you can tell. So here's to that not happening. Finally, from my perspective, Godzilla made a huge heap of cash over the weekend in the US and around the world, over 100 million, which immediately had Warners and Legendary deciding quite sensibly to make a follow-up called Godzilla v. Mothra, I don't know.
Dawn of Monsters.
Yeah. Anyway, so that movie is happening, and they are now looking at grand total, everything added up from all territories, $196 million
in
its opening weekend. And knowing that movies stake so much of their acumen in the future on their opening weekend, with streaming prices are monitored off that, and TV prices are monitored off that, and DVD and Blu-ray sales are all pitched with that, this has done them very well. And a lot of people have come back saying they loved it, and a lot of people saying they didn't love it. The forums have been abuzz with discussions of this.
We talked about a little bit about it. Where does it go next? I mean, it's kind of, you've just got to bring a new threat. Where's that new threat going to come from?
Mecha Godzilla.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Space Godzilla.
Yes, indeed. Is it aliens? Is it, Superman? Is it, who knows?
Well, I think aliens would kind of lose that kind of rather nice metaphorical angle that they had on this one. Godzilla's always kind of represented something, or should, at his best, represent something for us as a species. If you bring in aliens, it kind of messes with the
this is true,
with the metaphor. So this, I'd rather they didn't do that. Having said that, I'm fine with giant moths and tiny little fairy priestesses, so what do I know?
I'm just really worried that the Godzilla franchise might lose its natural, or what it is at its core, if it produces too many sequels. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No.
No, okay.
It's kind of interesting, though, that this Godzilla made almost, is what we were getting, not quite, what the Roland Emmerich one made in its lifetime at the US box office. That made about $136 million. This made $93 million, and is what we get, which is...
In the US, that is.
In the US, obviously in the US. Worldwide, Emmerich one made $379 million, or thereabouts. I'm not reading it off the website, honest. But it's interesting to me that this one has hit where the Emmerich one just missed completely.
Well, I think for a start, it looks like Godzilla, which doesn't hurt. I think the Emmerich one got a lot of fire for, obviously, as we've discussed, looking like Jimmy Hill.
Mm.
And I think maybe, I think actually the Emmerich one may have had a little bit more of a struggle to get it into people's consciousness. It may have been a little bit more niche. You know, people maybe didn't know Godzilla quite as well. I mean, maybe the cartoon, but apart from that, nobody had really seen the films necessarily. Whereas now with the internet, with the Emmerich film, the name is more in the public consciousness, the name is more familiar, and this one may have benefited from that.
Interestingly, though, the Emmerich one was sold, like, completely on the nose as a monster movie. Mm-hmm. This one they pitched as a disaster film, and I think that worked. Also, the other interesting thing is, apparently, I was reading this yesterday, so I may got the stats slightly wrong, but apparently I think over 60% of people who went to see it during the opening weekend were over 25. So we're looking at an older audience here. Mm. This isn't your teenagers.
But I don't think teenagers are the driving force at the box office anymore, and I think it's been heading that way for quite some time. Like, this isn't
North
just
tickets
this
cost
isn't
£16.50 each.
It's partly that, and partly the fact that, you know, they're frankly the teenage boys who were the demographic that they've traditionally been aimed at, 80s, 90s, noughties, they're staying home and playing games for the most part. That's why games are making more money than cinema openings. I think they are becoming a less and less important quadrant, if you will, of the audience, and that you're seeing, you know, women are now 51% of the average blockbuster market, and older people yeah,
over 25
are now becoming a much more important sector of the market.
It was 58% male, so it's, you know, pretty close to 50-50 split on the audience, male, female.
And that's for Godzilla, which is more male skewing than many.
I
guess the proof of the pudding with this one will be in how it does in its second weekend. But to put it in context, biggest opening this year so far has been Captain America 2, which had 96 million, and Amazing Spider-Man 2 had 91. I'm just surprised. I honestly didn't think that Godzilla had it in him, to be honest. I didn't think he had this sort of wide appeal.
I have faith in the old lizard.
Yeah, it's cool. And hopefully, I wasn't a huge fan of this movie. Hopefully, the sequel will address some of the problems, as in give us some human characters to root for. But that's just me, and I'm just being weird. Of course, there's another big bit of news which has come out, which is that the very first standalone Star Wars movie will be directed by Godzilla's Gareth Edwards and written by Gary Whitta of The Book of Eli and After Earth fame. This is interesting. We don't know much about it, apart from the fact it's going to come out in December 2016. Gareth Edwards will take a break from directing Godzilla. He'll come back for Godzilla 2 and 3. Thomas Tull, the president of Legendary Films, has already announced, which means that those movies couldn't hit until at least 2017, 2018, something like that.
You'd think,
I'd be honestly surprised they didn't, if Edwards didn't move on.
I mean, it's testament to how well Godzilla has done and how highly regarded Gareth Edwards is, which is fantastic for him. It couldn't happen to a nicer man. I would also say that it's an interesting choice and a kind of encouraging one. We want to see good and interesting filmmakers working in the Star Wars universe. That's a cool sign. I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical, perhaps, on the Star Wars prequels, simply because I could not care less about Boba Fett. And I actively don't want to know more about Han Solo's backstory.
Oh, God, no.
So, and those are the two of the rumoured subjects for this film. So, you know, those two, I'm going to find it very hard to get enthusiastic about, but the involvement of somebody like Edwards will help me, I'm sure. But we don't know the subject. I mean, in his quote about this, he said, "Ever since I saw Star Wars, I knew exactly what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, join the Rebel Alliance. I could not be more excited and honoured to go on this mission with Lucasfilm." Is that a clue, Rebel Alliance? Maybe. Does that mean it's less likely to be Boba and more likely to be Yoda or someone like that?
Porkins. I'd love to see a Porkins origin tale. Frankly, I don't want to see any origin tales. There's part of me, the cynical part of me, that really doesn't want to see any Star Wars standalone movies, no matter who's attached. I think they will dilute the impact of the episodes themselves. Yeah, I know there are commercial reasons why this is happening. And as long as there are artistic reasons as well, then I think that's going to be a good thing.
And listen, I mean, the spin-offs don't have to do that. If they're their own thing, if they are just in that universe, it could be totally awesome.
It could be.
I'm talking as someone who saw Battle for Endor. I would not rule out the possibility of there being a great Star Wars spin-off in there.
But I do not want to see prequels. I do not want to see origin tales of Boba Fett. This is probably exactly what they're going to announce the minute this podcast goes live. And obviously, we could be brought round by brilliant filmmaking. But I'd rather they did something new. There was that talk of Zack Snyder, who pitched a sort of Seven Samurai thing with Jedis out in the out in the outer rim of the galaxy. That sounds cool. And yeah. Gareth Edwards, he's a cool filmmaker. I think he's a really, in the flesh, he's a really, really fun guy. He's a really nice guy. A very funny guy as well. And I think, hopefully, being in the Star Wars universe will allow him to rediscover that fun that I thought was missing from Godzilla. There obviously have been people quipping on the internet that it'll be a Rancor origin movie, because he only does monsters. But I think this is going to be fun. I just don't want to stay away from Han, stay away from Boba.
I think the Rancor actually would be a great subject, because the relationship to the Rancor and the Rancor Keeper is one of the great emotional beats of Return of the Jedi. Yes, do that.
Do that indeed. I guess more information about that will leak out soon enough. But yeah, very interesting indeed. And good to see Gareth Edwards, who, you know, Godzilla's done really, really well. I know Weird Empire didn't like the film as much as some, but
it is a recommendation, Chris.
Three stars is a recommendation, indeed. But also, Gary Whitta, you know, you may have detected a note of sarcasm when I read his credits. But he also, as I was reminded, wrote the Walking Dead game, which is excellent. So, you know, my feeling is, and I wonder how true this may be, my feeling is that maybe they've gone in together with a pitch and gone, don't do Han Solo, don't do Boba Fett, do this movie instead, which is really cool. And Disney and Lucasfilm have gone, yeah, okay.
That would be great. Mon Mothma origin.
Neenum.
Finally. No, Mon Mothma. We need some more women up in Star Wars, so let's go for that.
Who says Neenum's a man?
I apologise.
You don't know. Bib Fortuna. I'm just listening to Star Wars characters now. All right, so that's it for movie news. We all good? All right, time now for a second X-interview with the only man who's appeared in every single one of the X-Men movies, thanks, of course, to a brief but memorable cameo in X-Men First Class. He is the one and only Wolverine, a.k.a. Hugh Jackman. And when he came to London recently, Helen and I went along to speak to him, and then a very last-minute appointment meant I had to leave poor Helen to fend for herself against Jackman's abs of truth.
Poor me.
Poor Helen. Here are the results. Do try and filter out the raw terror in her voice.
That's not terror.
Enjoy.
So, Hugh Jackman, welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Thank you.
As we record this, we're actually recording this in advance of the release of Days of Future Past.
Yes.
So, just last night, you picked up our Empire Icon prize.
Yeah, that was crazy. I mean, that was crazy. It was amazing. I had a particular moment when I was there, because I wasn't aware that Tom Cruise, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Emma Thompson were going to be in the room. So, as I got up on stage and collected that award, I was like, wow, I still think of Icons as in those guys. So it was amazing to me to be included, and I was very, very honoured and grateful and humbled by it. Mm.
You do have a reputation as the most modest man alive, so, you know.
That's not true. I mean, maybe publicly, but actually privately, I have a fair bit of arrogance. Hey, I did a one-man show called Hugh Jackman Back on Broadway, where I told stories about my life and sang my favourite songs. That's not modesty, really. That's complete indulgence.
There is a limit, then. That's kind of good. James McAvoy was there last night as well, and he was talking to us and calling you. He's got two different nicknames for you. Mm. Huge Action.
Yes.
And Hugo Boss.
Yeah. He's terrific, man. I'm such a fan of his. I was always a fan of his, and my wife as well, massive fan. I was so impressed with him. I got to tell you, the first day he had on set is a massive scene with Patrick Stewart. So we'd been shooting for a month. He comes on. It's about a 3-page scene and full on. And an iconic moment, of course, you know, to have same character face each other off. It's just, I'm not going to call it a dream sequence, but it has that kind of effect. I was lying on the slab, my character supposedly sort of unconscious, and I knew I was off camera, so I was opening my eyes and I was taking a little squiz, and I was just so impressed. And I went up to him and I said, man, hard to nail that scene on any given day, but to turn up day one with an opposite Patrick Stewart who was in a flow, you know, he's got great courage and he's just such a great actor. And I was thrilled he won last night, you know, against the odds, particularly after the Oscars and everything and BAFTAs. For him to get it, I was very, you know, very happy.
Yeah, I think it was maybe a bit much. Filth was a bit much for those voters, whereas our readers are a bit more like, yeah.
Right. Love it.
Swearing, sex, fine.
Yeah.
No problem. I mean, this film, obviously, as you've kind of mentioned there, you know, sees a lot of jumping about in times. Mm. How do you keep track of Wolverine's timeline at this point? Do you have a wall chart somewhere at home in your office? You know,
no, I just don't make him too smart so that at any point it all feels the same to him.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, he's 200 years old, so it's like he's got about a 7-day memory. No, it was really fun, mainly because going back in time, I always felt actually Wolverine is a classic 70s character. And it's funny how, I'll be honest with you, that X-Men First Class changed things in that it was very deliberately 60s. I'm going off on a tangent now, and it felt 60s and weirdly timeless at the same time. But when we were making the Wolverine parts of that, the X-Men Origins Wolverine,
yeah,
a lot of that was meant to be set back then, but there was a lot of studio notes of, no, I don't want to look too much like that. Make it, you can kind of feel like that, but I don't want flares, I don't want anything. And so there's a lot more confidence either in the audience, I think, or just in the world itself. This felt 70s. And I kept in every scene, every time I turned on a car, I just wanted him to say, yeah, that's what cars are like. Like, he just feels like that's where he's
a
at
muscle car
happiest.
Kind of guy, basically.
Completely. Hair, the mutton chops, leather jackets.
Brian said that you were the first one to sign on to this film. I guess because, you know, you're the time traveler in this one. I was confidently predicting right, left and centre when this film was first announced. Oh, it's obviously going to be Professor X who sends his consciousness back. That makes sense.
Yes.
But that's because I didn't think for a moment that they'd actually include Wolverine in the Days of Future Past film. So, you know,
well, actually, I'm going to give something away there. There is a line where he says, I was meant to go back.
Ah.
So you're right. In that, actually, for the task that needs to be done, it would have been much easier if he went back because he kind of knows what needs to be done and much easier to ease the fears and worries or downward slide of your own character when you know what the future is like. To send Wolverine back on almost a diplomatic mission is really the last person. In fact, he's kind of asking me to do for him what he did for me in X-Men 1, which is not what I want to do. And every instinct for me is just to go, oh, sod it, and just go in and, Start slashing, just take care of it and, you know, get out of there. But that's not going to do the trick.
And did it feel like a reunion of the old gang, or did it feel
100%.
Like, yeah.
I mean, and because Ian and Patrick were doing a play together, we had to shoot that first.
Right.
So not only cast-wise, and I'll never forget that first day, I woke up with a great feeling. It sort of surprised me, a great feeling of gratitude and kind of wonderment that we were going back to this with that cast. And it was particularly special for me because it was my first American movie. So I was quite nervous at first. And I felt very grateful to Brian because that character and the part that he gave me and that group, almost everything I've ever done since has been, you can trace back to that and the opportunities it's given me. But it was a reunion. It was fantastic. There was Hallie pregnant. Every time they called cut, she was like unzipping, cut, and she would take a few breaths. Give me a second before we go again. Okay. And, you know, she was quite pregnant at the time and they might have had to CGI a few little bits here and there, but it was fantastic. I just have this image of Ian and Patrick walking along arm in arm on their way to set. And it was terrific. It was really great. And Brian was in a great space. We had a great script. There was a lot of confidence about the project from the beginning. And I was glad we got to do it that way around, have that reunion first.
Yeah. I was going to say, actually, I was just on Twitter this weekend admiring pictures of Ian and Patrick together. Right. I mean, you've got to try and persuade them during the press tour. I'm sure you're going to see them again soon, to just keep taking these ridiculous pictures all over the world.
Yes, right?
You know, whether they're in a play together or not, we don't care. We just want more.
It's true. They really, they're an amazing kind of couple of friends and actors. And I knew them, of course, growing up for me in Australia. When I was at drama school, I used to watch the John Barton tapes, these great Shakespearean tapes, which had Ian and Patrick and all David Suchet and all the great actors, Judy Dench and Ben Kingsley. And so I knew them, these people I looked up to. And I knew America didn't really know them, and they knew Patrick from Star Trek. But I was like, you can understand, this is De Niro and Pacino in Heat. This is going to be iconic. And it was. And I thought, I remember feeling, in a way, for James, and who I knew from Last King of Scotland, and Michael, who I didn't know, Michael, I thought they got massive shoes to fill. Yeah. And I asked Ian and Patrick, actually, how they felt about the guys, and both of them were thrilled.
Oh, really?
Yes, thrilled. Absolutely thrilled.
Well, I have to say, I've seen Macbeth on stage twice, and both times it was a Professor X playing Macbeth.
Oh,
and
I
now
see,
Michael
right.
Fassbender is making the film of it. So you know, right. they're clearly kind of following in the footsteps. So,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of working together.
And you haven't seen Ian McKellen's?
I haven't seen Ian McKellen's.
It's on, you can get it. It's a BBC yeah. with Judi Dench. It's an incredible production.
So I should really probably rank all four together. That would be the thing.
You should, but don't tell them the answer.
No, definitely. No. Wouldn't dream.
Until after the movie's released.
Now, they're already planning X-Men Apocalypse for after this one.
Yeah.
But Wolverine hasn't been listed for that one yet. What do you think Wolverine's doing during the 1980s? Is he teaching a jazzercise class?
That's
somewhere?
A good point. I just can't see him with shoulder pads.
No.
I can't see that. So, well, that's my era. Yeah, I can't see him. I think he starts to check out around about the 80s with synthesizers, big hair. Rick Astley, Wham. It's just not his decade, is it?
Big hair, maybe, but the rest of it, maybe not so much.
Exactly. I have no idea. But I have spoken to Brian. He said there is a place for me there. He's not sure what it is yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. It's very early days, I suppose, very on that early. One. We should probably leave you until this one's at least in the can first.
I'll tell you a little tidbit about that, because he was telling me about Apocalypse and about the history of it, of the character, and where it comes from. And as he was saying it, my son is a huge history buff, and I'm not going to tell you which particular part of history it's from. If you know the comic book, you'll probably know. But he was saying, oh, no, Brian, that's not it. And he goes, what do you mean? He goes, it's X, Y, and Z. And Brian turned to me and goes, I think your son's just named the villain of our next movie. So we'll see. If that turns out to be true, I'll let you know.
Wow. that's pretty good. He's giving script notes. And no
You're right,
age,
exactly.
Clearly.
Yeah.
What about other things you've got coming up? Obviously, there's Chappie.
Yes.
Neil Blomkamp. Have you? What stage are you at with that?
So it comes out the end of this year. We shot just in January now. So he's putting that together.
Okay.
I was so impressed with Neil, and I loved working with him. And this is just the wackiest, craziest character I am playing. And he's kind of the bad guy in it, and I loved doing it. It was fantastic. I had so much fun. And I think the movie, I know those fans of District 9 are going to love this movie. It's got a lot of humor in it too, and I don't know. I really loved it.
That's pretty cool. And you're also playing the bad guy in Pat.
I am, yeah. I'm having my little go of bad guys.
Moment.
Yeah, I'm having my run. He's very charming, kind of loves the sound of his own voice. It's me, really. Blackbeard, who is the most feared pirate, but he's a fun villain to play. So this is what I'm growing. The beginnings of what I'm growing.
I was going to say, because is this for a part, or is it just you haven't shaved?
No, this is not a choice. Imagine it coming out to more like here, like a punch kind of. So that's going to be a lot of fun. We've been rehearsing that this week, actually.
Okay.
And that's been terrific. Excellent. Nothing like some pirate workshops to get your inner kid back.
How's your, pirate speech?
It's pretty good.
That's very good.
Thank you very much.
And you've been enjoying fish and chips as well, so you're getting into the
Poppies.
Yep.
Went to Poppies today. Have you been to Poppies?
I haven't, no.
I hear it's the second best fish and chips.
Second
best. And I said, Alfie, he's been my driver for ages. I said, Alfie, what do you mean second best? He goes, oh, Governor, number one's in Wandsworth. Didn't think we had time for that. So we went for Poppies. Loved
Interesting.
It. Very nice. Bit of cod and chips, bit of vinegar, salt,
tartare
sauce. Happy days. That was about 9 o'clock this morning. No.
I've got one more.
So if I fall asleep, by the way, blame Poppies.
One more future project that Chris begged me to ask about, Carousel. Is that still on your to-do list? Because he's a Liverpool fan, so never walk alone.
Of course.
Very close to his heart.
You know, I haven't actually heard that project mentioned for about a year, which is not a good sign for Chris. I'm sorry. I would love to do it. I'm rapidly maybe getting too old for it, but it's a very difficult one to sell to studios. I am working, actually, there'll be a movie musical for me happening before that, which I'm doing with Fox, about P.T. Barnum, which is an all-original musical. And I was just discussing it. I'm very excited about it. We've got all-original music, which hasn't been done since, I think, Newsies or Fame.
Wow.
So, we're taking on somewhat of a Mount Everest there.
Gosh.
Yeah, but I'm very, very excited about that, yeah.
That'll be wicked. Well, we need more movie musicals. There have been a lot of stage adaptations in the last few years, but not that many kind of fresh stuff.
That's true, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm getting the nod to wind up. I've just got one final question.
From me. No. Listeners, I nodded. Enough of this.
He didn't.
No.
He's being modest again. in the last couple of X-Men movies, you have been the one to drop the F-bomb.
Yes.
Are you going to make it a trio?
By the way, I drop it all the time as Wolverine, to the point where Brian's like, could you just say the lines without swearing? We only have a limit. And I did on that cameo. I selfishly asked, is anyone else swearing? Because I love this line, but it'll only have real impact if I'm the only one. And so it was. But there, I do not drop it in this.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't want to tell you who does, do I? No. But it is dropped.
Okay.
Yes.
That will come as a family.
In a very family-friendly way.
Of course.
Of course.
Nothing but. Hugh Jackman, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
How was that?
It was fun. He's such a nice man. He's so ridiculously charming. It's unreal.
Is it true that he's contractually obliged to take his shirt off in every interview?
He made me promise not to say.
All right. Let's move on to reviews now. I guess a good place to start would be with the biggie. Return of the X-Men in the time-flipping, head-spinning Days of Future Past, in which Wolverine is sent back to 1973 by Charles Xavier, by Professor X and Magneto, played by Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen, to hook up with young Eric and Charles, played by Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy, to avert a disaster that plunges the world into darkness in the year 2023. Now, obviously, we're going to have a massive spoiler special podcast of this up Monday, May 26th, featuring not only writer-producer Simon Kinberg answering lots of questions about the movie, but also us nattering about it in huge detail. So this review will be fairly short, but what did we make of it?
This is very, very good indeed. Now, it is a complicated setup, and I think people who have skimped on some of their X movies in the past may find themselves briefly confused by what the heck is going on. Heck, if you didn't stay for the post-credit scenes in X-Men The Last Stand because you ran from the theatre in horror, you will be confused by the appearance of, in the future, Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen.
Or the Wolverine, even.
Or the Wolverine.
If you missed a Wolverine.
True. You will be confused by the reappearance of Patrick Stewart's Professor X, Ian McKellen's Magneto, and of course the Wolverine in the future. So this starts off in a world that has been devastated by robots called Sentinels, who were brought in to try and get control of the mutant problem, but have essentially destroyed half the globe in their quest to do so, and also have started targeting humans who might have genes that might produce mutants in future. So they've kind of devastated the world's population as well, more than decimated it. And that's where we kind of come into the story in this really, really dark, dark future, where the X-Men briefly come back together. They've obviously all been on the run in separate directions. They come back together and they have a plan to send Wolverine's consciousness back in time to his younger self 50 years before and try to avert this future, try to avert a single event which they reckon leads to this future. That event is the assassination of Peter Dinklage's Bolivar Trask by Jennifer Lawrence's Mystique. So Wolverine's consciousness sent back to his younger self to reunite James McAvoy's Charles, I'm just going to call him that for ease of reference, and Michael Eddie. Fassbender's Eric, not Eddie.
Charles and Eddie.
To try and convince Mystique to change her plan and save the future. That's the setup. That's complicated enough. You've also got huge numbers of characters who feature. They span the whole sort of X franchise to date, including, of course, First Class, but also introduce some new characters as well who all get sort of grace moments, but maybe not huge amounts of character development, I think it's fair to say.
Confused? You won't be. Actually, I don't think you will be, because I think this movie is really well scripted, really, really elegantly directed. It was a relief to me, because I've been on sets of movies and seen a lot of stuff and come away going, oh wow, that looks really, really cool, I hope this turns out okay, and then they turn out to be clunkers. This is not the case. I think this is, having rewatched X-Men 2, the second best X-Men movie.
Agree. Yeah,
it is. I love X-Men First Class, but for me this is better. It's deeper.
Yeah.
It's surprisingly fun, given that it starts off with pretty much the entire world in darkness and mutants being killed left, right and center, and it's just got this real sense of momentum and energy and emotion to it, which I really, really liked. And the clarity of storytelling here, given that a lesser director could have got bogged down in this, is phenomenal.
It is very good, yeah. The scripting, I mean, full marks to Kinberg, who, as well, you'll hear in the spoiler podcast in a few days, as well as actually having made a film that makes sense in itself, he also has clear explanations in his head of things that are off screen. This is a guy who has thought about it in depth, and it really pays off in the film, I think, as well.
And of course, as you'll also hear in the spoiler podcast, Simon Kinberg was also involved with X-Men First Class, but also X-Men The Last Stand. He was one of the writers in X-Men The Last Stand, and this is also almost his apology, as he says in our spoiler podcast, his mea culpa for The Last Stand, for getting the Dark Phoenix storyline spectacularly wrong. And I think this is a nice apology. Apology accepted, Simon. Apology accepted. Performances are great across the board. Yeah. Surprisingly, Wolverine is the lead of the movie, as you might expect, but he's not the emotional focus of the movie. It's James McAvoy's Charles Xavier who carries a lot of the emotional weight of this film. And I think McAvoy is phenomenal in this film. Mm. Phenomenal.
It's weird. It's almost like Charles is the Wolverine character.
Yeah.
And Wolverine is the Professor X character. It's very odd to watch. Yeah. And it's kind of, if you're a Wolverine fan, there is that caveat, though. You're not really seeing the Wolverine we're used to seeing in this film. It's a different Wolverine. It's an odd one.
Yeah.
And it's not a big criticism, but I was a little disappointed that apart from one particular scene, there wasn't that Wolverine-iness that I'd like to see.
I think this was 100% the Wolverine we know and love, honestly. I don't think he has to be berserk all the time to be Wolverine. So
but
maybe
he has to
this
be passionate.
Well, yes, he does, but I think he is, but he's, you know, he's keeping it for reasons you'll hear in the script. He's he's kind of having to keep it.
He has to be restrained.
Yeah.
And that's almost a shame.
I would like to say that the standout scene for me, or one of the standout scenes, was involving a character people were most worried about, which is Quicksilver. They thought that this super fast character who was revealed on our front cover wearing a pair of obviously 70s style goggles and a Pink Floyd t-shirt and a silvery jacket looked a bit dweeby, I guess. I don't know what the real objection was. They just didn't like the way he looked. But he runs away with it. Ha ha ha. That joke was good. So, yeah, look forward to his bits. He's not in it for a long time, but when he is in it, he is a riot.
He certainly is. It's great seeing the old X-Men back on screen. Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen, Halle Berry, Ellen Page. You know, it is very, very good seeing these guys again. It evokes a very nice, warm, nostalgic glow. And the New Mutants, as you said, Helen, they do get little things to do. Bishops and Sunspot and Warpath and Blink. But they're basically just there to display new powers.
Blink was great, I thought.
Yeah,
the visualisation of her power, I absolutely loved that.
We don't get a sense of them as characters, though. But to be fair, if you did, this movie would be 4 hours long. It would never end.
Should you spend your money to go and see this on the first weekend? And is this important for me to see ASAP? Well, I said a similar thing for Captain America: The Winter Soldier. This is a must-watch movie if you care about this franchise, because your friends will immediately want to talk to you about it. And if you're a notorious X-head, then they'll want to talk to you about it. It's a film that you walk out straight away and go, hang on, wait, what? Huh? How? And this is where the spoiler podcast is going to hopefully go down well. But if you're interested in X-Men, go and watch it as soon as you can. Pay that £16.50. I saw it on IMAX. I was lucky enough to get the opportunity to see it on IMAX, and I really benefited from that, from my perspective. Seeing the Futurescape, this humongous screen, I love that.
No, this is definitely the biggest X-Men movie to date. I think it's brilliantly acted. The action set pieces are great. There's a lovely set piece in the Pentagon. There's another one in Paris, and but it doesn't fall into that blockbuster trap of thinking bigger is better necessarily. There's scale by the end, definitely. But the emotional stakes were ratcheted up more, I would say, than the physical stakes, rather than things being blown up and things being smashed into other things, which so many blockbusters, even Captain America 2, which I think is fantastic, does fall foul of. Hello.
Just to put a tiny caveat in here, I think it's a great movie. I really enjoyed it. I do think there were a few things that could have been done better. I thought Mystique was a little bit shortchanged. Some of her decisions in the last act, which I obviously won't talk about, don't make any sense as far as I can see, and I thought that was a little bit of a weakness. I feel like she is a little bit more of a MacGuffin than a character at times, and I wish that she could have been a character throughout, because I think that would have worked better. Overall, I still really like it.
Actually, there was one element of this film in the casting of it that I really admired and I really liked. I really liked the fact that they cast Peter Dinklage as Trask, and the fact, you know, that he's a dwarf never came up. It was just there. They just cast him. It was never in the script. There's no recognition of it. And I think, you know, maybe this is the start of a new era, in the same way that, you know, now you can actually cast people who aren't necessarily the race that you were expecting the character to be, and it not be a talking point. So I thought that was an encouraging move.
And stay until the very, very, very end of the credits. Mm. There is a sting. It is there, but you've got to wait for it.
Yes.
There might be a problem with people who are not that invested in the film, possibly watching it with people who are, who will be loving it and roaring at moments that are very not as good as a wink, you know, hat tippy and that kind of thing. It's still worth seeing, though you may feel slightly out of the loop. It's still worth seeing.
Yeah, I do wonder what people who haven't seen any of the previous X-Men movies will feel going into this, because it plunges you straight in. and it presumes knowledge, which I always think is a slightly dangerous thing for a movie.
But I kind of love it at the same time. I love presumed knowledge. But
at the same time, we're seven films in.
Yes, seven.
So, but I think this is as good as a seventh installment of a franchise can be. 4 stars for X-Men Days of Future Past. And let's move on now. Blended, which is the third leg of the ongoing rom-com union of Drew Barrymore and Adam Sandler. So does this one urinate merrily on the good vibes and memories of The Wedding Singer, or even just slightly punch the nose of 51st Dates, which wasn't that bad?
Your question, therefore, is Blended splendid?
Is it splendid?
Splendid isn't the word I'd probably use, no. This is, so the setup is basically that you've got two single parents. Barrymore's character is Lauren, Sandler is Jim, and they go on this terrible first date. They go on this date, it couldn't be worse. They're clearly never going to see each other again, except that they then end up, in a bizarre twist, on holiday at the same resort with their respective families, and they're kind of thrown together. And wouldn't you know it?
What happens?
Well, I mean, this is going to shock you, Dan, but hold on to your seat, because what? There's a bit of a romance develops.
What?
Between who?
Between them. And
no.
They had that bad first date.
No way!
And they go to Africa.
Like Batman v Superman.
Yeah, they go to Africa. They go to South Africa. If you've ever been to South Africa, you'll probably know this huge industrial complex of Africanness, which is called Sun City, which is all about the traditional trappings of tribal Africa. And they're there, and they romp around, and they're elephants, and they get into a cheeky situation involving a parachute and, you know, other extreme activities. Safaris happen, and the kids say things that are inappropriate times, and that sounds like an innuendo.
Yeah, so it's not brilliant. It's certainly not The Wedding Singer good. I wouldn't even say it's 51st Dates good. I mean, you know, I think Barrymore's presence makes Sandler more bearable than he is in, say, Growing Ups, where he's pretty much totally unbearable. But it's still not quite funny enough.
There is a bit where Drew Barrymore vomits French onion soup all over her chest.
Well, exactly. So, yeah, we gave this 2 stars.
No, why? It sounds great. Give him more stars. Can we do that? Hack into the mainframe.
No.
I really have a soft spot for Adam Sandler, and he's just on this horrible run of mediocrity / sheer eye-gouging awfulness, and I don't think he's going to pull out of it. Such a shame. Such a shame. Speaking of eye-gouging awfulness, we don't have a review? Folks from Pat the Movie?
No, they have not allowed us to see it. There was a premiere. What I will say,
yeah,
because we can't review this film, but no. I just want you to know before you go and see it with your kids or by yourself, whatever, it involves evil robot Pats, evil robot postman Pats, and it also involves a Simon Cowell character called Simon Cowbell, who does a X Factor style show that Postman Pat is part of.
And will we be more Cowbell at the end of it?
Probably not.
Jesse.
Everything I've heard about this is very good. Everything I've heard about this film is that it actually manages to get, you're getting Postman Pat wrong. Postman Pat is about Jesse getting lost or a piece of post not getting the right door. This is about robots and a singing competition.
Everyone knows there's no point having a movie unless it's got robots, aliens, monsters, superheroes, pirates, or singing in it.
Everybody knows is actually that's from Fireman Sam. Sam's the hero next door.
Out of those, I would actually accept pirates, but I'm not sure about the rest.
Anyway, so we haven't seen the film. That is not a review. The review will be up shortly.
That's all the time we have, I'm afraid. For that is it for this week's Empire Podcast in association with Squarespace. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Doug Liman, the director of Edge of Tomorrow, and its sequel, Larry Mullen Jr. of next week. Anyone?
Charity laugh, Chris. Charity laugh.
Sam Riley, who's one of the stars of Maleficent, will also be dropping into the pod booth. You've done that already. That's good fun. That's in the bag. We'll be discussing those movies and much more besides.
I just also want to remind you guys, as I reminded you guys last week, still 18 quid if you go to the website to subscribe for 12 issues. But I've organised for people who don't live in the UK 10% off international orders if you want to subscribe. And you use the code EPODCAST on the checkout. EPODCAST. We're just trying to organise it for... I know a lot of people that don't live in the UK and they listen to this podcast. So here's to you. Otherwise, new subscribers, 18 quid for a year of The Empire. Yes. So that's exciting. You have 1 week left. Next Thursday will be when the super special Soaraway Excellent 300th issue will be off sale. So you haven't picked it up already. You've got until then to buy it.
I'll pick it up. and then buy it.
Yes,
don't just pick it up and then put it down again.
Or buy it and leave it there. That would also be a waste.
Yeah, but do buy it. That's the main thing we're trying to tell
you. The important thing is that you should buy it and give us 5 stars and tell us we're great and buy us presents.
Anyway, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Ali.
It's Ali. By the way, fact fans, if you love facts, listen to the new QI podcast. QI Elves are doing a podcast, which has been going for a little while now, and it's excellent. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish, and it's just full of facts, full of lovely, tasty, juicy facts. So go have a listen.
Do you just plug another podcast as I'm saying goodbye?
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, they've just finished this one, so.
Yeah, fair enough. People have stopped listening by now, anyway. It's goodbye from Dan.
I'd like to go now.
Awesome. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to project my consciousness into my younger self and tell myself not to go see Project X. See you next week. Bye.